What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the renowned scholar, philosopher, and translator of the entire Talmud, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking about and playing with Jewish ideas about God lately, a rather dangerous and perhaps obscure way for a Reform rabbi to spend his time, no? You see, unlike many religions, Judaism doesn't actually require its adherents to stick to a particular formula of belief. There's no binding Jewish code, no Israelite creed we memorize as little kids and are obligated to recite regularly to confirm our membership in the tribe. In fact, you can make a case for the only really abiding piece of theology we Jews ever came up with in our first 2,000 years of existence to be the whole notion of one God, what we call monotheism. When Jews say the Shema, the text is from Deuteronomy in the Torah, but it's been turned into a prayer used in every evening and morning service and the first text taught to a Jewish kid. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. When we say that, we are pretty much fresh out of other ideas that all Jews totally agree upon, at least religiously. Are you supposed to be good? Of course. Should you do mitzvot, acts of moral benefit to the world? Absolutely. But does this constitute an actual belief system? A creed for life? Well, not exactly. In fact, the first guy to decide that Judaism needed a creed and to promulgate one and circulate it everywhere was Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, the great Spanish Jewish scholar, teacher, physician, author, and philosopher, and he did it in the 12th century, 3,000 years after Judaism started with Abraham. And since we had managed for so long without any such simple creed, after he formulated his 13 principles of belief, Maimonides was positively vilified by many of the other Jewish authorities of the day. How can you reduce Judaism to 13 neat principles of faith, they said, when a real knowledgeable Jew is supposed to study the whole Talmud, all six orders and 66 tractates of Jewish law, plus all the commentaries? You have to know all of that in order to understand Judaism, not some simple code. Well, this tendency to avoid stating in simple black and white terms just what Judaism believes, and to rely instead on the sharp minds and empathetic hearts of the Jewish people to discern how we are supposed to believe and live, makes it great to actually be a Jew, but really, really hard to explain to others just exactly what that means. And it makes teaching a class like Basic Judaism, which should be pretty simple for an experienced teacher, you know, like a rabbi, quite challenging, in fact. How do you boil Judaism down to a simple set code of beliefs when it's really an entire complex system of study and practice and personal commitment, a way of life? While you might not be able to do this easily, it turns out that in the last century, faced with the challenge of living in dynamic open societies like America, a number of really bright and creative minds have tried to address this very question. And the results they've produced form a wide range of potential ways to think about both God and Judaism that give Jews today a choice between diverse and vibrant interpretations of belief and practice. In today's Jewish world, you can be a Jewish existentialist like Franz Rosenzweig or Martin Buber, accepting only what you've come to feel is really authentic and true and meaningful for you personally. Or you might be a Jewish empiricist like Abraham Joshua Heschel, believing primarily in the miraculous quality of God's presence in the world and our need to act to further that design. You might be a religious naturalist like Mordechai Kaplan, believing Judaism's a culture, a kind of civilization, in which every expression has validity if it's embraced by Jews. Or you can believe in the central importance of sacred Jewish community, the covenant agreement that we fulfill God's design in the world by the ways we create holiness, respect, and ethics in our world. Or, alternatively, you could see the imperative created by the Holocaust as the most profoundly motivating element in Judaism, compelling us to act to create Jewish sanctuary and self-determination. Or, well, there are so many other ways to understand being Jewish now. Each is deep and interesting and exciting. All of them have some validity. And again, we find ourselves unable to say simply what being Jewish really means, or what exactly we believe that we all share. Beyond the oneness of God. Which brings us to that central theme, and it's not a bad one. Today is the Global Day of Jewish Learning, a wonderful addition to the calendar created by our guest on Too Jewish This Morning, the extraordinary scholar Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz. That theme is Shema Yisrael for the Global Day of Jewish Learning this time, the oneness of God. As Rabbi Steinsaltz puts it, we Jews are slowly becoming strangers to one another. The divisions are not just ideological or political. They are harsher than that. Because we face free-floating hatred, the opposite of love freely given, we are losing our common language, the words we use to share, the words we use to recognize one another. The only cure for baseless hatred, sinat chinam, is baseless love. As Rabbi Steinsaltz puts it, since we live in a time when people of differing beliefs and opinions no longer mix with one another, we have to find a way to open the gates. It's not enough to seek peace, we must pursue it. Instead of useless dialogue and discussion, let's find the words and ideas we can share, and let us say them together. A small beginning is the Shema. These are words and profound thoughts to which we can still agree. Indeed. And so to play us in on this Global Day of Jewish Learning, here's a version of the Shema, as sung by the great cantor and tenor Jan Pierce, a little classical chazanut as grand opera, the Shema from the Kedusha, composed by Abraham Elstein.
Shema Yisrael,
that was cantor and tenor Jan Pierce singing Shema Yisrael, proclaiming the oneness of God, the central statement of Jewish belief and the binding element of the unity of the Jewish people. May that unity be affirmed on this Global Day of Jewish Learning. The man who created that day, our guest this morning, has been called by Time Magazine a once-in-a-millennium scholar, has received the Israel Prize for his monumental translation of the Talmud, and wrote one of the finest expositions of Jewish mysticism. Meet this remarkable man, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, and find out why he created the Global Day of Jewish Learning when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
On Sunday afternoon, November 20th, 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, the beautiful sacred service by Swiss-American composer Ernest Bloch will be performed by the Tucson Masterworks Chorale. This fantastic piece of music was originally commissioned by San Francisco's Temple Emmanuel, and it's one of the 20th century's finest classical works. Bloch described this passionate and romantic setting of text for the Jewish Saturday morning service as a cosmic poem, a glorification of the laws of the universe. For the Bloch Sacred Service, the Masterworks Chorale is conducted by Marcella Molina and will feature Rabbi Samuel M. Kohan as the baritone soloist. Don't miss this extraordinary performance Sunday, November 20th at 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson. For tickets or more information, call the Tucson Masterworks Chorale at 730-5640 or Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. The other day when I was struggling to come up with an idea for a new Mama's commercial, I overheard a family talking about their son's high school football team. My mind raced back to 1964 in Long Island, New York, when my brother Vinny played football for the West Hempstead High School Rams. Vinny was a great player, and of course the whole Spina family went to each and every game. After the games, we'd often come home and Mom would make one of her delicious Sicilian-style pizzas. My mouth still waters when I think of the great rich-tasting tomato sauce and creamy fresh mozzarella cheese sitting on top of her warm, homemade semolina dough. It's the exact great taste we put into the pizzas we make every day at our Mama's restaurants in Tucson. You know, I love thinking about football and the good old days in New York. I just wish all this reminiscing would help me come up with a good idea for a new radio commercial. Repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are honored to welcome the Too Jewish this morning, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, teacher, philosopher, social critic, prolific author who has been hailed by Time Magazine as a once-in-a-millennium scholar. Sort of since Maimonides, I'm not sure there has been someone who has accomplished more than Adin Steinsaltz. His lifelong work in Jewish education earned him the Israel Prize, his country's highest honor. Born in Jerusalem in 1937 to secular parents, Chilonim, Rabbi Steinsaltz studied physics and chemistry at Hebrew University. At the age of 24, he became Israel's youngest school principal. In 1965, he began his monumental Hebrew translation of the Aramaic Talmud and his commentary, completed just last year for the Siyum at the first Global Day of Jewish Learning. Today is the second Global Day of Jewish Learning. He's also the author and guiding force behind the English translation of the Talmud, the Steinsaltz Talmud, and his classic work on Kabbalah, The 13-Petaled Rose, was published in 1980, is now available in many languages, and is extremely influential as well. He's authored some 60 books and over 600 articles on subjects, well, on everything, more or less. We're honored to welcome Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz. Good morning.
I hope that after seeing all these praises that are very colorful and not always very accurate, so I hope that you could survive it.
God willing, as we say. It's not a hesped here exactly. Tell us, why did you decide when you began the tremendous work that was translating the Talmud into modern Hebrew? Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I thought it was needed. The fact that I, at the time, I didn't know that it will take me about 40 years of life was something that's just a slight miscalculation. I thought I'll do it in 15.
You've always been an optimist, then.
I have been an optimist. You see, in a certain way, I've just been asked recently, why are Jews optimists? And I said, if we weren't optimists, we would all of us commit suicide. We have to be optimists in order to survive. So that is ingrained in us, to be optimists. So we are optimists as a people. And some of us are more optimists, especially if you connect with optimism, a will to do some work, then there are some results also.
When you began this work, it was almost, I don't know how to say this precisely, but it must have seemed controversial to translate the Talmud, which required learning not only Aramaic, but all the intricacies of it to really understand it. It must have seemed a little heretical to make it so available. Was it treated as such?
Look, it's in itself, clearly, nobody could say anything about it, because basically, the Talmud is a book that is supposed to be learned. It needs to be, if it is to be learned, so it has to be taught, and has to be taught in the best way that you can teach it. So in that sense, there is not a point about being heretical about it, whether you explain it more or you explain it even more. It was in a way, it was a matter of, you shouldn't put yourself in the same position as the classical commentator as Rashi, which I try not to do. See, I know the difference, but still, it is not heretical, but it seems to be something like a huge amount of hubris to do it.
Chutzpah, we would say.
Yes. I'm using especially the Greek word because it is not chutzpah in that sense, in that Jewish sense. This is a kind of
Greek hubris,
so to say.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz in a few moments when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
needs.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set for May 30th to June 12th of 2012. If you're interested in going with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, we started talking last week about the relationship of American Jewish community in Israel and how whether that's changing, how it's changing. It's also maybe demographically changing. Younger American Jews less supportive of Israel unless they're Orthodox. It's very difficult, I think, to constantly hear Israel criticized and not allow it to affect your perception of Israel, even if you think the criticism is completely unwarranted, if you think it's unfair, if you think it's false. General media, the international media, and to some degree American media isn't very positive on Israel, even though American public opinion is very supportive of Israel. How long does it take before you start to listen to this stuff, even if you don't think it's essentially true?
I think that's a very good point. People that open the media here constantly hear criticism of Israel. By the way, they don't hear the same criticism on other countries. Even countries that are doing things that are by far worse than anything that Israel have ever done or imagined
Syria,
to do.
Syria, Iran.
Turkey, Iran, even Western countries, you know, in Spain, you have things that are, you know, things that are the same and people don't talk about. Scotland doesn't have its freedom yet, and that's in England.
Yeah, the Basque area of Spain, they're not particularly happy. So sure, there's lots of situations like that. I heard somebody say Abbas said it at the UN. You know, the only occupation in the world is in Palestine. I was thinking that'd be a little bit of a surprise to the people in Tibet.
Yeah, people in Tibet and even people in you know, South Sahara, for instance, that was occupied by Morocco. It's still under Moroccan control and they're denied a state. But, you know, I think the more interesting question is about the need of young generations to have a voice. And our tendency in the American society, in the Western society, to speak in sound bites. And I think sometimes, especially the one that critic Israel more, they like to present a false picture of a very simple situation. You know, a situation where there are good and bad, black and white. Reality is not that simple. Reality is complex. And understanding a complex situation, understanding a complex conflict, requires effort. You know, you need to go, you need to read articles, you need to hear both sides, you need to learn, you need to understand deeper. In many cases, I feel that unfortunately many people are not willing to do this effort and, you know, to do this extra mile of learning and studying and seeing that the picture is really not black and white. It's a lot of gray, a lot of colors. It's very complex. And I think sometimes our generation is wrong by coming to this next generation, to the young ones, with those sound bites, telling them as a hasbara approach, here are the bullet points, this is what you should think, instead of challenging them and giving them some place for their voice, but then challenging them with questions and sending them back to the books to go and learn and come up with answers. Because when you do learn, suddenly you see that the things are more complex, and suddenly you see that some of the criticism is not in place. Also, I think we should distinguish between criticism that comes from love and care and demonizing that comes from hate. which is something completely different.
Yeah, for sure. I do think it's an interesting challenge, and it's not going away. And if anything, it's going to require more creativity and more effort over the coming years. Guy, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder, of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar, and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, Downtown Kitchen Cocktails, best place downtown to get a meal any time of day.
We just celebrated our first year anniversary.
Mazel
tov. Serving, thank you. Lunch, dinner, happy hour starts at 4 every day. We have late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights with live music. It really is. We are busy from the time we open the doors. It's so much fun to be downtown.
It's a great thing to go there and then go on and see a show, isn't it?
Pre-performance, people are really get busy then. It's fantastic. Make your reservations. Come in and eat before the theater or the symphony or the opera. Then come back afterwards and have some dessert.
What's the best way to make reservation for Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails?
Just get on the phone and give us a call, 623-7700, or go to our website, downtownkitchen.com.
You can also get there through the Janos website, I think, janos.com.
We make it easy to find us.
Thanks, Janos. See you for the holidays, Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom, and welcome back from a recovery from illness.
Good morning, Rabbi. It's very nice to be here.
We are met on Global Jewish Learning Day, created by Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz and his foundation to promote tolerance in the Jewish world. The big theme this year is Shema Yisrael, unity. Tolerance is an elusive goal in our world. What's really going on there? You know, it seems like that old Tom Lehrer song. Oh, the white folks hate the black folks, and the black folks hate the white folks. To hate all but the right folks is an old established rule.
And isn't the chorus line, and everybody hates the Jews?
And everybody, that's the last line, right? And everybody hates the Jews, right?
Right, right.
Does seem that way sometimes, doesn't it?
The days of my youth. Well, you know, it's interesting because just last night, I taught a class for 2.5 hours in the history of anti-Semitism, and it was followed by another class for 1.5 hours related to anti-Semitism. And the question that young people ask, whether they're Jewish or not, is, why is anti-Semitism so persistent? Why didn't people learn from the Holocaust? And part of the
My kids ask me that.
Right. Everybody asks that. I think part of the answer is that it's not only anti-Semitism, which is so incredibly persistent. It's all kinds of irrational intolerance that, you know, among Muslims, the Shiites and the Sunni, and then among Sunni, the Wahhabis versus the Hanbalis, whatever. There's people in their fierce allegiance to a group or their need for a sense of belonging always seem to identify throughout history and throughout the world, and regardless of what cultural milieu we grow up in, them and us. And everybody who's them is to be feared or hated or attacked or whatever. And humanity, it seems to me, hasn't done a great job of moving past this, in spite of great teachings in nearly all the serious religions about how we should love our neighbors as ourselves. We should not do unto others that which is hateful to us.
The Ahavta Re'acha Kamocha,
exactly.
You know, comes from Leviticus. It's spread everywhere, the golden
and
rule.
And even probably earlier than that is the notion that Jews embrace fully, that we're all created in God's image. So there's a bit of godliness in each of us, and that needs to be recognized and saluted. And that alone should be grounds for not only tolerance, but inclusiveness, love, support, et cetera, et cetera. Instead, we find that even, although it's probably slightly less true in Buddhist cultures than in others, that even while we pay lip service to the notion that we're all created in the image of God, we have reactions that are negative viscerally and that sometimes get translated into words and actions of discrimination against groups which, for one reason or another, at least in a certain context, are vulnerable. Fat people, short people, gay people, people with the wrong skin color, people with the wrong type of Christianity or the wrong type of Islam or the wrong type of Judaism. And even among right. Orthodox Jews, you have the tension, which sometimes escalated into violence, between Hasidim and Misnagdim. And they're Orthodox Jews
they're all
who
Orthodox
from the
Jews.
Outside look like this should be one group where everybody tolerates each other. Ha!
Well, I tolerate you, I think. And
very well, in spite of who I am.
I think because of who you are. Thanks, Tom. It's a great subject and certainly one that is extremely important in our world today.
Well, and I think we should probably continue talking about it a little bit.
And we will. Thanks. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Sadie is 65 years old, has never married, yet she desperately wants a baby of her own. And with the help of the amazing technology of modern science and a famed fertility specialist, Sadie finally has her miracle baby, a 65-year-old first-time mother. When Sadie gets home from the hospital, all her friends and relatives come to see her to meet the newest member of her family. But when they ask to see the baby, Sadie just says, "Not yet." A little later, their friends and relatives ask again to see the baby. Again, Sadie says, "Not yet." Finally, a little irritated, they say, "So when can we see the baby?" And Sadie replies, "When the baby cries." "Why do we have to wait until the baby cries?" the relatives say. And Sadie replies, "Because I forgot where I put it." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and remember where you put it. This week we read the Torah portion of Chaye Sarah, which marks a transition in our Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, the first Jewish father and Jewish mother, towards the next generation, featuring Isaac and Rebekah. But first, we begin with an ending. At the start of the portion, we're told of the length of Sarah's life, and almost by accident, we learn of Sarah's death. "The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years," the Sedra begins. And the famous Midrash on it tells us Sarah was just as beautiful at age 100 as she had been at 20, and that she was just as free of sin at 20 as she had been at 7. A fine encomium for a significant figure who now passes from the scene. Chaye Sarah is also a portion filled with negotiations that will have a great influence on the future of the fledgling religion, someday to be known as Judaism. The first extended section of Chaye Sarah is actually dedicated to arranging for Sarah's funeral. It involves Abraham purchasing the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, the first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will eventually be known as the Land of Israel. That cave in Hebron will become the burial place not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah, eventually all find their final resting place in Machpelah. In Chaye Sarah, the purchase of this plot involves an extended bargaining session with the Hittite who owns it, the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the world, establishing Jewish legitimacy in the Middle East at a very early point in history. I once visited Machpelah many years ago, when it was safe to travel to Hebron. It's an interesting shrine, not worth the potential danger to life and limb implicit in a trip to Palestinian Hebron in the West Bank these days. Well, then the narrative in Genesis moves us forward with one last important detailed episode of Abraham's life. Abraham's old. He sees that his son Isaac hasn't married, perhaps seems unlikely to do so without parental intervention. Abraham charges his trusted servant to go back to the old country, you know, Sumeria, today's Iraq, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry and carry on the line of true believers in the one God. After a great journey and the first extended prayer in the Torah, the servant meets Rebekah drawing water from the city well in Haran. He knows she is the one for Isaac because she shows generosity and intelligence. He too bargains, in this case through Rebekah's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, the servant arranges for her to become Isaac's wife. But at the crucial moment of the narrative, Rebekah's family puts the question to her. Will you go with this man? That is, will she leave all she has known and journey to an unknown land? and a future husband she's never met. The final negotiation at Chaya Sara is brief. Rebecca agrees to go along with alacrity. Yes, she'll leave the homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown to her. In this, she imitates Abraham a generation before. And so she goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and of monotheism is assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebecca and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, these three elements remain our principal goals today, and often they still require negotiation to achieve. A secure land of Israel, our children and grandchildren's commitment to Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. When we come back on Two Jewish, our outstanding guest, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, the great translator of the whole Talmud and a fantastic scholar, will tell us about the mystical book that was never written and yet exists. It's one of his. Find out how that can be when we return on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers, you can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy called Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a liar in a private conversation with President Obama that was, well, amplified to a whole bunch of reporters. "I can't stand him anymore. He's a liar," Sarkozy said in comments first reported in French by the website Arrêt sur Image. The comment came during an exchange between Sarkozy and Obama on November 3rd at the G20 conference in Cannes. Obama responded by saying, "You may be sick of him, but me, I have to deal with him every day." Several journalists overheard the exchange, which was captured by a live microphone unbeknownst to the two leaders. was not immediately reported. The Aret Surimaj website said Sarkozy was responding to Obama's concern that the French leader had not warned him about France's surprise vote in favor of Palestinian UNESCO membership. The website also reported that Obama asked Sarkozy to try to convince the Palestinians to slow down their bid for UN membership. You have to pass the message along to the Palestinians that they must stop this immediately, Obama said of the membership bid. Sarkozy confirmed that France would not take any unilateral decisions during the forthcoming Security Council debate on the subject. I'm with you on that, Obama replied. Several journalists said they heard the private conversation right before a joint news conference by the two leaders. Obama and Sarkozy were speaking in a room equipped with mics, normally used to facilitate translation during public speaking. An event organizer did not distribute the headphones typically used to connect to the translation boxes, but several journalists plugged in their own earphones, or I guess their earbuds more likely, and could hear 3 minutes at the end of this private conversation. Well, in one sense, this seems like a controversy over very little. That's how Israeli leaders are playing it, saying that powerful, ego-driven people often say unguarded things that reflect only the tension of the moment. In another sense, all of these men, Sarkozy, Obama, and Netanyahu, are politicians, which means that they pretty much lie all the time. So what's the big deal? But in another way, it's a bit troubling that the president of France would chat with the president of the United States about what a liar the prime minister of Israel is. Now, in Israel, nearly every prominent political leader has, at one time or another, called Bibi Netanyahu a liar, the latest being Gilad Sharon, son of former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, whose new biography of his dad came out last month. Gilad Sharon will be a guest of Two Jewish in a few weeks, and in his book, Ariel Sharon says to Netanyahu, "A liar you were, and a liar you have remained," which is much stronger than what Sarkozy actually said to Obama. I'm sure that the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin of blessed memory, whose 16th Yahrzeit we just observed last week, had some choice words about Bibi's honesty, in private at least. Of course, Netanyahu has always played much better to U.S. congressmen and the American press than he has to heads of state in private. All in all, a minor political squall, but pretty darn entertaining. I bet those two guys will be much more careful about open microphones from now on. In other news, four members of the Oxford University Conservative Association have resigned over anti-Semitism and snobbery. The four senior members said they were quitting the association after the members sang a song with a Nazi theme during an evening meeting billed as Port and Policy. Student members of the club are facing disciplinary action by the university and the Conservative Party. Both have launched investigations. Two prime ministers and 13 cabinet ministers of England are among the Oxford University Conservative Association Club's alumni. Well, what happened? The members reportedly sang a song that begins with the line, "Dashing through the Reich, killing lots of kikes." Ugh. Nothing like that dry British humor, especially when it comes to anti-Semitic jokes about Nazis murdering Jews. How droll. The Oxford Conservative Club has faced accusations of racism in the past. In 2000, four members were expelled for making Nazi salutes. Oy. And three deaths to report in the Jewish world, which reflect on the great diversity of our people. Actor Sid Melton, who played the incompetent handyman on Green Acres, and about 300 other roles as comedy relief in movies and TV series. The guy who made Morton's of Chicago a worldwide restaurant brand, Alan Bernstein, and Alan Mandelbaum, whose gorgeous English translation of the Divine Comedy of Dante set a world standard for translations. May their memories all bring blessing. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our esteemed guest this morning, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, one of the really great teachers, commentators, philosophers, social critics, and authors in the Jewish world. Born in Jerusalem in 1937 to Chilonim, to secular parents, he studied physics and chemistry at Hebrew University. He became Israel's youngest school principal at the age of 24, completed his monumental Hebrew translation and commentary on the Talmud, begun in 1965, just last year, 46 volumes. He's also the author of
The 13-Petaled Rose, one of the really best one-volume books on Jewish spirituality and mysticism on Kabbalah. He's written over 60 books and 600 articles and continues to work as an important teacher and spiritual mentor. Rabbi Steinsaltz, you have served places like the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies in Washington, D.C., the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, extremely important places of secular learning. How do you fit in there? How does it feel to you?
Oh, in fact, some of these places look like a very, very much like a modern time yeshiva. Very few obligations, and you can sit and do whatever you want. It looks like a some kind of a kollel.
Very interesting. So sort of a kollel for not necessarily Jewish scholars.
Yes, well, whatever you have in the kollel is... I don't know if they check everybody in the kollel for whether he's circumcised. In fact, but basically it's some kind of like a kollel. You sit, you learn. You don't have usually very clear, well defined obligations that you have to begin at this hour, to finish at this hour. And if you are a good student, it means that you work much harder than you ever did before.
A different question. You came from a secular background. You came to Chabad. How did you find your way? Tell us a little bit about that process.
My way to Yiddishkeit is a more internal thing, and I usually don't discuss it. Even though, unlike so many other people, it was never a result or connected with any kind, not with a trauma, not with anything like it. Like a break or a disappointment or anything like this. It was a very different and very, I would say, basically healthy way. This was about my Yiddishkeit. Now, about Chabad, a part of it was almost by chance. See, I didn't go to Chabad per se. I went to Yiddishkeit. Within doing that, I encountered Chabad. I was not what I call one of those that were rescued or saved by Chabad. I came to Chabad willingly and a little bit by all kinds of many different strange connections. To give you an example, I come. I don't look like that. But I come from quite what I call good ancestry. Good in the what I call the Jewish way. It contains a very nice list of ancestors, famous ancestors. None of them was ever connected with Chabad. So it is, in my case, something like you are walking in a wonderful. And a wonderful avenue, and you pick up one of the palaces, and you enter there. That's my this the beginning of my connection.
So, having entered the palace, having found your way to Chabad, you know it's a very different kind of environment, and you are an extraordinary scholar. They respect scholarship, surely, but you weren't sort of from the hierarchy, so to speak. How did you find your place within the movement?
Oh, I did. Look, I didn't really search to be a part of the administration or a part of the bureaucracy. I have been, and being there was not connected with what I call with trying to get any special position. So I didn't have any political or semi-political or demi-political relationships. I came in, and I've been there. So that connection that I have is not because you don't have a bureaucracy, which I call with tickets. You have, and you are not a card-carrying member of the movement. So you can be there, and you are there.
And then you do your work, and it's not, it's just as part of
then the... Then I do my work and do whatever I am connected. I suppose I have written directly and indirectly a fair number with also of books and articles that are connected one way or another with Chabad. And I'm still doing it, I'm still teaching it, and so on. So I feel myself very comfortable with it. And I don't have to get any special approval from anybody there.
You know, your book on Kabbalah, The 13-Petaled Rose, very beautiful book. And how did you come to organize it the way you did? Why did you make the choices you did? I know it was 30 years ago you wrote it, but tell us a little bit about that.
I received a series of questions. This was a kind of basically answering a list of loose questions.
Loose questions.
And yes, and the strangest thing is, even though it doesn't look like that, it was never written. I just dictated it.
Huh.
So it doesn't sound like a dictation. It is not a speech. Interestingly, when they tried to do the Hebrew edition, because it was done in Hebrew, was translated in quite a number of languages from that. So they thought that they would possibly do some editing. And after a time, they decided that the original was good enough. And so it goes smoothly, and I would say it sounds like it is well written. As I said, it was a book that was never written.
I love that. That seems somehow very Kabbalistic. It's a book, but it was never written. It's revealed but concealed.
Well, it is a kind of a book that you see if I may say it, the book is in a way astonishing me in more than one way. One of the things is that the book has an enormous impact on people. You see why I began to teach quite young, and teaching people that were twice or three times my age. And my only way of defending myself was that I am not teaching my own wisdom. I'm just serving as a channel. And as I am serving as a channel, not of my, say, 20 odd years of wisdom, but I'm serving as a channel for more than 3,000 years of wisdom. So I can say things because of that. In that way, I think that in that book, I served as a channel. And I hope it when people read it, they have a feel of that touch, not with me, but with the author, so to say.
I understand. So the Hebrew Talmud is completed. The English translation of the Talmud, which made really a publishing sensation in the United States, the Steinsaltz Talmud. Tell us the stance.
I hope that it was one of the, at least it did at the time, one thing, which is important. I suppose it changed definitely the notion about the word Talmud. It is no longer derogatory. The word had a slight connotation, and you can find it in all dictionaries and all descriptions. I think that stopped.
Fascinating.
So this in itself is something.
So it's really a conceptual change. I mean, you know, first of all, if people thought about the Talmud at all, if they weren't observant or very knowledgeable Jews, as you say, you know, people would talk about Talmudic logic or Talmudism. Pilpul was sort of the connotation. But they published these beautiful gold embossed volumes of the Steinsaltz Talmud. The reference guide alone is a tremendous resource that you created. It really was a publishing sensation. People who had never thought about, even bought a Jewish book, suddenly bought the Steinsaltz Talmud. I want to thank Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz for a marvelous visit here on Too Jewish. Today is the Global Day of Jewish Learning, which he and his institute have created. You can find out more about it online. Or go to a synagogue near you, and as he said, let my people know. Go and learn. Zeal Gemor. Thank you, Rabbi Steinsaltz.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Itamar Rabinovich. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website or friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Chazan Marcelo Gimlin, the song Shir Shalom, a song of peace for all Israel, with a kids' choir. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shir Shalom al kol am Yisrael. Hava nasira, shir shalom, shir shalom.